Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we are going to talk about the heaping trash fire that is the tax bill that ended up passing in the Senate. And then, of course, Flynn indictment and what Robert Mueller is doing with that investigation. So big show today. It's going to be super fun.
Yes.
And by fun, I mean horrible.
There's a lot to sort of process and go through, and you know, admittedly, Devin and I are both a little bit like Hot Mess Express today.
Yeah. Oh,
for
100%.
Various reasons. I have been sick for a week straight, and I'm hanging on. But I could not miss a recording of this show, especially on a day like today where, I mean, legislatively, such a huge bill passed on Friday night. I mean, I was like, I know I'm like a grandma at this point and I go to bed really early, but even on West Coast time, I was barely staying awake trying to see what was going to happen. I mean, I had a strong feeling it was going to pass, but I mean, just that whole process was so fucked up. I was so angry.
So fucked up. You know, I get asked a lot about self-care and like how you can keep up with the news cycle and everything going on. And I mean, the reality of the situation is sometimes it just overtakes me.
Yeah.
Last night I was having trouble sleeping. Just the amount of news, and then plus like shit with my family, like Thanksgiving is always a mess. So just like dealing with everything. And I'm just like, yeah, I texted Sarah this morning. I'm like, yeah, I didn't sleep last night. I'm running a little late this morning.
Yeah. The point is, both of us were like, we can't miss doing an episode.
We have a
lot to sort of unpack as usual. But yeah, I mean, the tax bill is something that both of us feel very strongly about. And then, of course, we thought it was super cute of us that we did it a whole like regular episode on Thursday. We should have known that Robert Mueller would deliver Flynn Friday the next day. So of course, lots going on with the Russia investigation and what's going on in Trumplandia there. So a big, big show. So without further ado, let's just jump into it. Okay, Devin, so before we really, really, really dive in, let's go into some listener feedback. So what email do you want to read for us today?
One of our hellions named Amar emailed us, and they said, quote, "I'm a huge fan of the pod and have been listening since one of my friends mentioned it on Twitter. As the subject line says, I'm a student photojournalist, and last week, a right-wing blogger named Lucian Wintrich was arrested at my school." They go to University of Connecticut. "After attacking a girl during a lecture. I've included a link in case you guys haven't heard about it." And they're a photojournalist for The Daily Campus, which is University of Connecticut's student paper.
And I saw this video circulating on Twitter last week, and it was like, the whole event was really, really disgusting. But anyway, continue, Devin.
So they continue. "Anyways, I want to say that your idea of gratitude checks helped me cover the event. As a person of color, covering these kind of events are always hard because I know the people being attacked are the people that I identify with. It's hard to do your job when you're simultaneously not trying to react to the attacks. Whenever these things get difficult, I'm reminded of the gratitude checks you do, and it helps me find some kind of light. For instance, with this event, I was able to focus on and be grateful for the resistance that stood up to this bully and managed to keep my composure. Got some pretty dope photos, too, to which I say, fact check, true.
Yes.
They're great.
Yes.
Thank you for all the amazing work you do and keep fighting the good fight." I loved that.
Yeah. I just want to say, Amar, thank you for doing amazing work and finding an avenue, which is photojournalism, to channel that, because shit like this... First of all, this event was called something like "It's Okay to Be White," which is just there's this whole movement like "It's Okay to Be White." And I saw someone on Twitter who was like, "Let's be real. It's not about it's okay to be white. It's really about it's okay to be a white supremacist, because no one's telling us it's not okay to be white. Like, that's not a thing." This whole event where people are saying they feel attacked for being white is total bullshit. I mean,
it's total bullshit.
It's total bullshit.
This event was also sponsored by the University of Connecticut Republicans Union or club. I don't know. At Davis, they called it the Republicans Union. And that's just so frustrating and so frightening that that this is the sort of that a political sort of faction on campus is associating themselves with.
Well,
this.
I mean, look at what's happening with the fucking modern day Republican Party. That's exactly what they did with Trump. They endorsed him.
Exactly.
I mean, that's how he's president. Like, it's awful. I mean, like that connection doesn't surprise me. But anyway, Amar, thank you for writing to us. And, you know, like make sure that you're also prioritizing your own safety. I think that's absolutely important. But keep fighting the good fight. And thank you for supporting the show as well. Okay, Devin, so let's jump right into, I know, one of your favorite issues to talk about.
It is.
Which I love. I love that, like, you know, we have complementary issues that were...
Interests,
exactly. I mean, it's not fun today because we're talking about a shitty thing that happened on Friday night. But we are going to dive into tax policy and this huge bill that passed so, so quickly and unnecessarily on Friday. Like, the early hours of Saturday morning, if we're being... technical.
Well, and the thing is we talked about this on our last show. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a breakneck pace for naming a fucking post office. Like, to overhaul the tax code, this is just ridiculous. So just want to give a quick reminder of what's in this, you know, flaming pile of garbage. The long and short of it is it's a huge tax break for corporations and the richest 1% of Americans. Mm-hmm. So they're lowering the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. And they are taking money from the middle class and giving it to the top 1%.
And the lower class too.
Like, that's true.
Middle. And I think a lot of times people, I'm not even just saying you, a lot of times people focus on the middle class, but it's the middle class and the lowest economic groups as well. And this isn't like an original phrase that I've thought of, but it's really reverse Robin Hood. Like, that's what it is.
Right. Well, and actually the first group that we'll see an immediate tax increase are those making less than $10,000 a year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's pretty ridiculous. And I think one of the most chilling statistics is that over the next 10 years, those making between $40,000 and $50,000 a year will pay $5.3 billion more in taxes.
Yeah.
And those making $1 million or more will pay $5.8 billion less in taxes. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, sums up this whole bill nicely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of specifics about it. There are a lot of weird things. There's a lot of pork rolling that it's trying to do. It's repealing the ACA's individual mandate. There are a couple of other things that we're going to talk about.
But that's like the bill in essence, just to like set the scene. So it's like, just so we understand, like, in general, what was at stake.
So on Friday night, this bill was still being written on the Senate floor. And many of the pages had handwritten notes in the margins. And I actually heard that one of the pages had to be submitted as artwork because the writing itself was so illegible.
Yeah. I don't know if it was like literally still being written on the Senate floor, but it was still being written a couple of hours before they were going to go on the Senate floor. And you saw in dramatic videos, I think John Tester of Montana had this great video where he was in his office and he was like, just got the fucking text of this bill and here's all the fucking, you know, handwritten shit. And it's not like, you know, and I've heard this, it's not like handwritten notes are that uncommon in final text of the bill, but to have it happen a couple of hours before this huge, huge bill.
Call me a purist, but I feel like a bill that is going to be majorly rewriting,
of course,
a core policy of our country should at least, you know, I would say 95% be typed up. I don't know.
Well, I think the point was everything about this process was so irregular and so completely absurd that was just highlighting how ridiculous it all was. And like Mitch McConnell was like trying to gaslight the shit out of everyone afterward and being like, I don't know why Democrats are complaining, it was regular order. This is what people who lose say. They talk about the process, but the process was regular. And it was like, fuck you, dude, this was bullshit. Everything about this was bullshit.
The Democrats made one last push on Friday night to send this whole mess back to committee, seeing as there were, you know, fucking handwritten notes in the goddamn margins.
Well, this was like before. I mean, this was before there were handwritten notes in the goddamn margins. But
that's true.
Yes.
Well, which is even worse. Which is even worse. So,
but the, I mean, the Democrats were like, this whole thing has been expedited to like on steroids
to a degree, and yeah, so to like a degree that we can't even understand.
Because like we mentioned on Thursday's show, there was no CBO score. There were no like hearings. There were no markups. Like there was
no
nothing.
Expert testimony. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just don't understand. Yeah. Anyway, the Republicans blocked that motion and forced a vote and, you know, on this garbage. So all but one Republican, Bob Corker, and I'm not giving Bob Corker cookies here. It's just he didn't vote for it, voted for the bill. And
I will say Bob Corker could have fucking voted.
Kept it in committee.
He could have kept it in committee.
Yeah. And also, I don't understand. He's retiring. Like, I feel like at this point he could go like truly no fucks Bob Corker, which I would love to see.
Yeah.
But he's not. And well, it's very frustrating.
And same with like someone like Jeff Flake, right? Like Jeff Flake ended up voting for this bill. And it's like, oh, yeah, that fucking big old Senate speech you gave about like standing up to Trump and Trumpism.
Yeah, fuck
you are still rubber stamping his agenda because at the end of the day, you are still fundamentally Republican and you still fundamentally agree with most of his agenda. So again, double fuck you.
This did raise a lot of questions for me, though. Mainly, what did the so-called holdout senators get? Like, how did McConnell get them? And we have kind of a sketchy idea. So Collins voted for this trash because, and she said, quote, "I got a commitment that we're going to pass two bills, including the Alexander Murray bill, and one that I've authored that will help offset the individual mandate repeal by lowering premiums."
Ugh.
So she said, I quote, "I also got an ironclad commitment that we're not going to see cuts in the Medicaid, Medicare program as a result of this bill." But the problem is she's putting a lot of faith, A, in the Republican leadership that they're going to hold to these promises.
No.
And two, McConnell doesn't even have full control over that because this is going to get kicked back to the House and the House is going to have to approve this too. So she's not just working with senators on what she wants. She also has to work with House Republicans, which... It's they lied to her.
Well,
basically.
And also like Republicans, what they want to go after next are these big social safety net programs.
Right, right. They're trying to reverse the New Deal of FDR's era, and that's always been their goal. And this is just sort of the most blatant example of them trying to do so.
I think you've been had, Senator Collins. I think you've been had.
So Jeff Flake, as we said, voted for it. You know, he was really concerned about the $1 trillion deficit that it was going to add to the budget.
Yeah.
But he said he voted yes because Senate leadership promised to include him in negotiations around a permanent fix for DACA recipients. So basically they're saying, well, vote for this and we'll include you in a plan to get the DACA situation under control, which again, we're taking these promises at face value here. And Jeff Flake is actually retiring. So who knows if they're going to get to DACA
before
he retires.
Exactly.
So, McCain is a fucking hypocrite who gives a fuck what he got. I don't care.
Okay, I want to take a second and rail on McCain. I want to take a hot second because McCain is the biggest motherfucking hypocrite for me of them all.
Yeah,
He voted no on that ACA repeal.
And got all the cookies for
that. He got all the cookies for that. And, you know, he talked about process and regular order. And now he's foregoing that. He's also a fucking cancer patient. And he's okay with this individual mandate being repealed.
Right.
Like, fuck you. Sorry. Yeah. I just, like, McCain, like, maverick my ass times 1,000. Like, McCain is... honestly, like I'm gonna stop myself right there because I'm gonna say things that are probably like over the line and too mean, like, and that I will probably regret, but like,
right,
fuck you, John McCain. Like, double fuck you.
I mean, if one more person calls John McCain a maverick, I've said it before, I'm just gonna fucking lose. I'm just gonna start throwing shit.
Canceled.
And then finally Murkowski, and this is the one that I am particularly interested in and that poses a particularly difficult issue for Republicans. Murkowski voted yes because McConnell added an amendment to this tax bill to open up drilling rights in Alaska, which is something that Murkowski has been trying to get since she became a senator.
Right.
So I would just like to take a quick digression and say that Sarah and I had a long debate after last episode as to whether or not this bill was a, quote, omnibus bill. and it hasn't been called long. I mean, like long debate. Yeah. It hasn't been called that in major news outlets, which is why we didn't refer to it as an omnibus. But omnibus refers to a bill that has a bunch of bullshit crap rolled into it that has nothing to do with the original bill. So I say this is a goddamn omnibus bill. I will die on this hill, but I digress.
I'm looking forward to the listener feedback. Please give us a little civics lesson here because, yeah.
Yeah, because like we looked up the definition. I was like, by the definition, this is a fucking omnibus bill. Again, I digress. I just, you know, wanted to throw that out there. But
this
so
is Devin's petty. Devin will die on this hill. She will put this it on the podcast. She needs to be proven correct.
Yeah, exactly. This is the hill. Like, normally I'm pretty flexible. This is not.
Yeah.
So here's the problem. 12 Republican members of the House of Representatives sent a letter to McConnell opposing this provision that would open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to energy exploration, which are these drilling rights. So it was not included in the House bill, and it's a major priority for Murkowski and the reason she voted yes to this bill. So it's going to be an interesting process to reconcile these two things. She wants this energy exploration, and House Republicans are like, oh, hell no. So they're going to have to figure out what to do.
Oh, that's super interesting.
Yeah. So it poses a very interesting problem. And this leads us nicely into what happens next with this bill.
Before we get into what happens next, can I just have a really quick rant about the media coverage of this?
Yes.
Because I was seeing push alerts and newspaper articles refer to the passage of this bill as like political victories or a political win for Republicans. Right. And that pissed me the fuck off. Because if you're going to take what happened throughout the last few weeks or so and what transpired on Friday night and distill it down to ultimately it's just a political win, you're doing journalism wrong. What you should be focusing on is how this is going to affect people.
And at the end of the day, calling it a political win, it says a lot about the priorities of the Republican Party, because it wasn't just a tax bill that they passed. It's how they passed it. It's what's in the bill. So,
but not just about not just the Republican Party, but of mainstream media. What they care about, you know?
Right. That's what I'm saying. So calling this a major political victory.
Yeah.
Is basically saying that the breakdown of our democratic process is a political victory. And they left that out of the narrative. They just looked at this bill as I read somewhere that covering politics is like covering sports now.
Yeah.
Where you don't dive deeply into the strategy, at least for the most part. You kind of call the game, as it were. I know I'm mangling my sports metaphors.
No, you're doing great. Keep going. Keep going.
So you're kind of just calling the game, right? You're commenting on the two teams and like what they're doing, and but you don't really get deeper than that. I think you're right. You're doing journalism wrong. The whole point is to get deeper into it and to talk about the real world effects that this legislation is going to have on people. I don't understand. Tax policy is very complicated and it's very dry. And it's recently had sort of like a sexy makeover with all of this sort of political coverage. But at the end of the day, you can't divorce the policy from the real world implications, which I think a lot of people end up doing.
Obviously, like you can't avoid the politics of it all. But when you're centering the sort of partisanship and tribalism of it all, you lose the importance of what this is all about.
Right.
And that's what frustrated the hell out of me, because Republicans have completely bastardized the process. They've completely bastardized the norms of how you craft and implement and pass policy. And
major policy.
Major policy. This isn't a post office naming. This is tax code. And, you know, I saw people on Twitter who were like, you know, Democrats actually respect the process. And at this point, like, if and when we get back to power, like, we can't just, like try to institute regular order again, because we're just going to let Republicans walk all over us again. Like Republicans are completely bastardizing the process to protect the powerful. Like we got to like do what we need to do to protect the vulnerable. And I completely agree with that.
I completely agree with that. It's scary to me though. That's scary.
It sucks. It completely sucks. But like, it's just going to keep being, you know, Lucy in the football. Like Democrats regain power. We're going to try to be the adults in the room who, you know, try to institute regular order again, but then Republicans are going to regain power and they're not going to give a shit. So we might as well like steamroll and try to protect vulnerable people, because what Republicans do is they don't give a shit and they try to pass everything under the sun to protect the powerful. Like, we just can't go back at this point. I mean, they stole a goddamn Supreme Court seat when, you know, we had a Democratic president. Look what they're doing now with tax code. And, you know, the...
I literally can't talk about that Supreme Court seat because it makes me so fucking angry. Like,
it's like that quote we read aloud of Sarah Kendzior last week, yeah, of journalist's job is to
protect the vulnerable,
protect the most vulnerable people. And they're not doing it. They're not acting as like sort of a check on the powerful. So like, we got to do it as Democrats, right? Like, yeah, we got to act as that check. And we saw it in that the coverage of this tax bill is they just framed so many, you know, so many stories in mainstream media focused on the fact that it was a Republican win. And like, that's bullshit.
Well, and this whole sports coverage of politics, like calling things a win, mm-hmm, calling things, you know, a victory, celebrating like after the House did the ACA repeal and they, you know, celebrated in the Rose Garden. I mean, that sort of,
yeah,
political theater is truly disgusting, mm-hmm, to me. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the mainstream media is playing into that and is using that narrative that Republicans are giving them,
right,
is chilling. And I think you're right. If and when Democrats go back in power, when hopefully, you know, restoring regular order can't necessarily be a priority anymore. But that also really terrifies me. It's hard because I understand we can't go back. I understand, mm-hmm, that, you know, you have to play the game that's playing out in front of you, not to use more sports metaphors here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know, maybe I'm just a goody two shoes rule follower. but the presence of rules and boundaries it's what keeps politics in line.
We got to disrupt some shit now. We got to disrupt some shit because the other, right, side is disrupting it in the bad way.
So, right, we gotta just also think that we need to remember that to break the rules, you have to know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't just say, well, fuck everything. We have to have a strategy with it.
Of
and
course.
I think this is where the of Republicans course. Have gotten us every time, yep, is that they come
absolutely.
Up with a well-orchestrated, well-crafted strategy to blow up the game.
Well, because they're not, it's not necessarily they're breaking the rules, they're bending them, because these are,
right,
not
exactly.
rules, they're norms, right?
Right. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so we need to also come up with a well-orchestrated, well-crafted plan.
Definitely.
To combat that.
Definitely.
We can't just go in, like, you can't just, you know, rush it. We have to think through what we can do to make,
yeah,
real and lasting change.
Yeah.
So,
for sure.
All of that said,
yeah.
Let's talk about
I had
what
to
rules...
go on that rant because it was like...
No, I totally get it.
I was like raging.
Oh, I totally get it. Like I said, I can't talk with the Supreme Court seat without... I can't. I'll just derail this whole podcast.
Well, I get mad at myself about the Supreme Court seat because I was like, we should have been in the goddamn streets. Like, and I'm,
yeah,
like,
we should've.
That's on... I feel like that's on a lot of us.
So let's talk about the rules that are still in place.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what the next
what
steps
are. What are rules?
What are rules? What is
life
order?
Even? Yeah.
You know, these are legally mandated. This is what happens next. The Senate has passed its own version of the House bill. So now the House and Senate Republicans will get together in what's called a conference committee to create a bill that both chambers agree on to send to Trump's desk. So there are some rules that come with this conference committee. Those on the committee may not change a provision on which both houses agree, nor may they add anything that is not in one version or the other. So they can't come up with a brand new bill.
Right.
They can't just start from scratch.
They have to come to some sort of agreement.
Exactly. And if a provision was in both past versions, that provision has to stay. Mm-hmm. The final product from this conference is called a conference report, which is then passed by the majority of the members of the conference committee and then sent to the both the House and Senate floors for a final vote. And both the House and Senate have to pass this conference report outright for it to be sent to the president's desk.
And I think they want to do this really quickly. Like, they're trying to get this done by Christmas.
By the end of the year. I mean, yeah. Right, by Christmas. And so, but it's interesting because timing is going to be very key here.
Right.
Collins, who I talked about before, and what she was promised for voting yes, she told reporters on Tuesday that if she was going to vote on the Senate's tax bill, she wants to see these Obamacare stabilization bills passed before the conference report comes out. Mm. So they're trying to do this really quickly, but if they want Collins to vote for the, you know, the new conference bill, basically, they're going to have to get these stabilization packages passed, which is a whole other issue that that if they want to get this passed by Christmas, that might not even be possible. It doesn't give the Republicans a lot of time to get those health care bills passed.
Yeah.
And it requires Collins to put a lot of faith in Republican leadership that the House won't just pass the Senate's first bill without changes. The Senate version could go to the House and they could say, you know what, it's fine, and pass it. They don't have to do a conference report.
Faith in Republicans is just like, I know you, like, Collins, I know you're also a Republican, but like, don't do it.
Like, it's frustrating. But it's frustrating. And I was really disappointed with Collins and to some extent Murkowski, because I feel like they have been a more moderate voice. And I really think that they could have been these Czechs, these charismatic dissenters that I've been talking about for almost a fucking year now. And the fact that they weren't when it really came down to it was deeply disappointing. I'm kind of mad at myself that I was so disappointed because,
yeah,
you know, why set yourself up to be disappointed? But
I think this tax bill for me was like another like underline in the fact that like Republicans are Republicans are Republicans are Republicans. I mean, like,
yeah.
They fall in line. That's what they are. That's what they
do. It's frustrating because we need a functioning two-party system. A power vacuum on either side is not good for democracy.
But I think
we need opinions.
What I was gonna say, Devin, is we live in hyper-partisan times. Like,
right.
I think you're talking about a setup that that lives in an ideal world, and we don't live in that world. Like, we live in hyper-partisan times, and like,
oh, I get it.
I think that
I'm just saying that we should be putting more energy into creating. I don't even know what we can do about it. But we need a functioning two-party system. We need people to disagree to come to the best possible solution.
Yeah. And for me, like, I'm at a point where I'm so disgusted with Republicans. I don't even give a fuck about what they do on their side. I'm like, let's strengthen our own party and just like whoop their ass electorally and legislatively.
Oh,
like, I don't even
give
a shit. I'm like,
let's
fuck
them. But I do think that the health of our democracy is in peril, and we need to be very critical and very thoughtful about that.
About what?
About the fact that democracy is a delicate process, and we need to make sure that, I just think at the end of the day, we need dissenting opinions on both sides.
Well, I think
to create the best possible.
I think you're describing like an ideal scenario in which like Republicans aren't like heaping trash fire of bigotry and like, you know, ruling class like interests. And it's just like, but they're all in the pockets of like the Kochs and the Mercers. And they don't care about minority groups at the end of the day. Like, most of them don't. Like,
right. And it's disgusting.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm trying to say is that makes me really sad.
Yeah.
And to close out the section, I would just like to remind everybody that the GOP still hasn't funded the $14 billion CHIP bill to give healthcare to children.
Yes.
Because it is, quote, too expensive.
Ugh.
But they're cool with a $1.5 trillion deficit omnibus bill. And I will die on that hill to give money to the richest Americans. And that is what really, really makes me angry about this, is that in all of this coverage and all of this talk,
yeah,
they still haven't figured out how to give healthcare to children.
Okay. Okay, Devin, so now that we have gone through that fucking trash fire of a goddamn tax bill that...
Somewhere in the outline, and I didn't say it last section, but I was like, this bill is basically what they use to wipe their butts during the bathroom break. And I just wanted to get that joke on the record because I was really
That was really important for Devin. Like, she really, like, this was a big priority for her. Because, it is. It's so horrible. But unfortunately, we're all going to be living in shit because of this fucking bill. But actually, before we really get into this next section, what we didn't emphasize at the end of the last section is that because it's going to conference, it's not over. And we will have action items regarding this. So,
absolutely.
So put a pin in that. But... now let's transition to the Mueller end of things. We've gone from Capitol Hill and now we're going to special counsel's office because what happened on Friday? I mean, it's never a slow news day. And, you know, as we know, we record an episode and then, our boy Bobby decides to pull a trick out of the hat.
I've said this before, but I think Bobby Mueller just really knows what to get me for Christmas. He's just kind of ramping up to it, you know?
Yeah.
It's still the PJ.
I think he listens to Hellbent and he's like, all right, Devin, we're on schedule.
On Friday, New York City cockroach Mike Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI.
Another one.
He lied about a meeting with the Russian ambassador Kislyak about... two conversations he had back in December. On December 22nd, Flynn asked Kislyak to help block the Obama decision to allow the United Nations to vote to condemn Israeli settlements. And he did that on behalf of Netanyahu, who's the Israeli prime minister.
This was during the presidential transition.
This was during the transition. So this was December 2016. This was after Trump won the election and during the transition. And then again on December 29th, a day after Obama imposed sanctions on Russia for fucking with our election, Flynn urged the Russian government to not escalate the situation and to wait because when the Trump administration comes in, they're going to deal with the sanctions and there's no need to escalate the situation.
Now, refresh my memory because so much shit has gone on that my brain is a little jumbled. Was this, where does this fall in the timeline of Sally Yates?
So Sally Yates went to Don McGahn in January of 2017.
Okay, right.
To say that Flynn had been compromised and was behaving inappropriately.
Because this was the phone call that Intel folks had listened in on, right?
Exactly. And so there's some speculation, and again, I can't confirm any of this, but there's speculation that Bob Mueller's team, the FBI knew that Flynn would lie.
Right.
And had already listened to those conversations when they spoke in January of 2017. Mm-hmm. This plea to lying to the FBI, it looks like a sweetheart deal. It looks like Flynn has agreed to cooperate fully with the Mueller investigation.
That's what our one of our recent guests, Renato Mariotti, said on Twitter. Because a lot of people were saying, oh, this is such like a light like plea, basically. Like, they don't really have anything on him. And Renato was saying... well, that's indicative that Flynn probably has something on a bigger fish because they wouldn't give him such a light deal if they didn't feel like he was going to cooperate and give up someone bigger. And because Flynn was a senior official, remember, he was the national security advisor for only 24 days for Trump, because he was such a senior official, the amount of people that he could potentially maybe give up is limited. It could be like a Don Jr., it could be a Jared Kushner, it could be a Jeff Sessions, right. It could be even the president himself. Who knows, right?
Well, this is important because it is clear that Flynn was not acting alone in his discussions with Kislyak.
Even though that's the White House spin, that's what Ty Cobb was trying to say. Like, oh, this is just Flynn. Like, they're really using the Mariah Carey, I don't know her defense. Yeah.
Right. Even though he was a top senior White House official, even if it was only for 24 days, he was still there.
Well, and he was involved in the transition. He was a top campaign surrogate, right?
The New York Times, was given emails, and those coupled with interviews and court documents filed on Friday it shows that Mike Flynn was in close contact with other members of the Trump transition team, senior members, both before and after he spoke to Kislyak.
Yeah.
On December 29th, which, reminder, that's the same day Flynn talked to Kislyak about not reacting to the sanctions.
Right.
KT McFarland, who was a transition advisor and Mike Flynn's deputy national security advisor, she wrote an email to a colleague that the sanctions announced hours before by the Obama administration in retaliation for Russia meddling in our election were aimed at discrediting Trump's victory. She said that these sanctions could make it harder for Trump to ease tensions with Russia, which, quote, has just thrown the USA election to him.
How much more obvious could it be? They're all Nimrods.
They're not the brightest crayons in the box.
I feel like,
I don't know.
Robert Mueller is just being handed this case on a silver platter. You know what I mean? Like, and it's just, it's wild because, like, we were given, like, thousands upon thousands of Hillary Clinton's emails. And, like, people, like, dissected them.
Yeah.
Like a fucking surgeon. And all of her right. emails were like, please print this document. Or like, what time is the good wife on? Or like,
right. Like, hang up the phone. I'm trying to fax.
Yeah. Or like, should we be bad and get a creme brulee? Like, let's split one, you know? Or like, please let's help this Yemeni girl get an education. You know what I mean? Like, and these fucking people are like, Russia's just thrown the U.S. election to Trump, like literally. And then like Don Jr. is like, I love Clinton dirt, especially later in the summer. Like these fucking people.
I know. So a White House lawyer is trying to say that Katie McFarlane meant that the Democrats were portraying that Russia threw the U.S. election to Trump. And it's kind of like, sure, Jan. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We believe you.
Can we also talk about how over the weekend Trump legit tweeted out and basically admitted to obstruction of justice in regards to Flynn?
Please, please. I would love to talk about
it. Like, he legit tweeted that out. And then people were like, hi, this is like a complete admission of obstruction of justice, which he basically already did to Lester Holt months ago in that NBC interview. And then then his people tried to backpedal and be like, no, that was some other guy. Like, it was his lawyer who crafted this tweet.
They're saying that John Dowd, Trump's personal lawyer, John Dowd, authored this tweet. He wrote it. And that who wrote it could change how significantly, you know, it's believed that Trump knew about Flynn's lying to the FBI. And John Dowd is now trying to say, this morning there was an article in Politico, that the president cannot be guilty of obstruction because he's the president. I mean, that's basically his argument. He's saying the president cannot obstruct justice because he is the chief law enforcement officer under the Constitution's Article 2 and has every right to express his view of any case. That's a direct quote from John Dowd, which is basically saying, well, he's above the law in this situation.
Which is bullshit.
He is not.
Also, he is not. There was some really interesting analysis from several legal experts who are saying it might seem like a like minutia, but the fact that Trump in his tweet said pled guilty instead yes. of pleaded, that he was like, no lawyer would say pled. They would say pleaded.
Right. Right. Which is almost like the font that took down.
Well, and it's also like Trump is a liar. Like everyone around him right. is a liar. Like,
well, and you also have to think, so Trump always says that he uses Twitter to communicate directly with the people.
Yeah.
He has never said that an office runs his Twitter account, that he does it himself. And so that this one tweet was written by someone else mm-hmm. seems highly unlikely.
Yeah.
Just right off the top.
Yeah.
Like, there's no evidence that Trump was involved directly in Flynn's discussions, but it's pretty well known that Jared Kushner was directing Flynn's interactions with Kislyak.
Yeah, so it's been reported, although I don't know if it's confirmed, that Kushner was the one who was directing Flynn to communicate with Kislyak.
Yes, Flynn has said that he was instructed to speak with Kislyak by senior members of the Trump transition team, which included Kushner and, friendly reminder, the transition team was led by Mike motherfucking Pence. So it's hard to believe that Pence wouldn't have known about this as the head of the transition team.
Yeah. Oh, and I guess Kushner directed Flynn to contact other foreign officials as well.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So basically the Kush is fucked.
I hope so. I mean, the Kush is like left off so many goddamn things in his like security clearance form. I mean, if that's any, that was like my indication that he was fucked. You know what I mean?
One of our listeners on the Facebook group was like, okay, so we left this off too. What did he disclose? His name and height?
Yeah, like that's literally probably the only truthful things, maybe, you know? Like, is his name even Jared Kushner?
Right, exactly. Are we sure? Trump's defenders have fewer and fewer cards to play in this situation. Mm-hmm. They always say, and I know this because I watch a lot of Law and Order.
This is how we know we're qualified to play prosecutors on a podcast. We're like, we watch a lot of Law and Order.
But I feel like just logically it tracks that he who goes first gets the best deal. Mm. So, you know, we already have two people who are given basically sweetheart deals of, you know, being charged with lying to the FBI in exchange for information. So,
well, yeah, but I mean, like, Papadopoulos is pretty low level compared to Flynn. Like,
sure,
Flynn is
sure,
the bigger.
But he was the first one. Mm-hmm. Right. But so it's like, but there's already two people who got good deals. Like, yeah. Time's running out. Like,
and I think that Flynn was probably eager to cooperate because he's probably trying to protect his son.
Absolutely. And I can understand that, mm-hmm. You know, even bad people love their kids.
Before we move on from this, like, I lived for the fact that when Flynn left the courthouse or whatever, people were chanting, "Lock him up." I'm like, listen,
Karma's a bitch and she keeps receipts.
Listen, Hillary Clinton, the day before, she was on her book tour and she was actually asked about Matt Lauer. And she said something to the effect of, "Every day I believe in karma a little bit more." And I just feel like that could be applied more broadly to like people like Mike Flynn. Like, yep. And so someone on Twitter was like, if Hillary Clinton doesn't get to drag like Mike Flynn to prison and chant like, yeah, lock him up, like, yeah, I don't even know. But like, these fucking people, like, they're
these
such
people,
hypocrites, they're such scum.
And there's been some reporting from Politico that everyone in Trump's orbit is paranoid and fucking scared, to which I say, Merry Christmas, motherfuckers.
Okay, Devin, so what are you grateful for today?
Okay, so in our Facebook group, our hellions are so smart and so wonderful. And two of our hellions have actually set up an end of the year hellion of the year bracket. They've set up some really tough choices. You know, so they did it by there are activists and journalists and organizations. And one of them was Planned Parenthood versus Girl Scouts of America. And I'm like, whoa.
How do you even choose?
I don't know. So it's really fun. And we're all voting and are all doing our own brackets. And it's just so cool to see the community get so involved and to, you know, kind of enjoy these sort of fun things that we can do. So it's just been really great to see everyone like debating like who's the coolest hellion of the year and you know, talking about all the kind of good political standouts from the past year. And I can't believe it's already been a year. And it's just been such a wild ride. And in my wildest dreams, I did not think that we would get to the point where two of our listeners would be making a hellion of the year bracket for, you know, for over 1,000 members to vote on. So I am so grateful,
yeah,
that, you know, we have such great, smart listeners and that we know how to have a good time. And I love that our idea of a good time is a hellion of the year bracket because we are nerdy as hell.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nerd. And like, just to take stock of like the people doing great work, I think,
right,
is always good because I think
so
it's
important.
That's why, I mean, that's a big part of why Devin and I do gratitude checks, because we talk, right, about things that are, you know, pretty shitty sometimes,
right,
and so it's always good to remember the
that
people locally and nationally who are doing the damn thing. So I love,
right,
that. That's a great gratitude,
yeah,
check.
So Sarah, what are you grateful for today?
You know, I have to go back to a personal thing. You know,
yes,
usually I'm looking for like an independent judiciary or something of that nature. But I mentioned at the top of the show that I've been sick for a week, and I thought it was a stomach bug that perhaps was passed to me by my boyfriend who was sick over Thanksgiving. But I discovered that it was it wasn't a stomach bug. It's probably something bacterial. And I kind of figured a couple days in when I wasn't getting better that there was something wrong. And right. I remember I kept telling Nick, I was like, this is not a stomach bug. Like, I feel like shit. It feels so much different than what a normal stomach bug is like. And I was like, I know there's something wrong with me. I know there's something wrong with me. And so I'm grateful for listening to my gut, literally, and like trusting it.
Right.
Because I went to the doctor on Wednesday. So that was like 4 days in. And I will say that my doctor, I wouldn't say that my doctor was dismissive per se, but they were, I don't know what the word is, but it didn't feel like I was being taken as seriously as I wanted to.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were like, you know, we'll do a blood test, we'll do a urine test. And there was like one more test that they were like, you probably don't need it, but do you want to do it anyway? And I was like, yes. And so I will say, and this is perhaps me speaking as like an admitted hypochondriac, but but I always do the test, always do the extra test. Always do the extra test, because I had a feeling that it was necessary, even though I was being told it wasn't. Right. And so by Saturday, I was feeling even worse and it wasn't going away. And so I called the on-call doctor on Saturday, and I was like, okay, can you tell me what the results of this extra test were like? And they were dragging their heels with the other tests. They were telling me, oh, you have to wait 7 to 10 days. But I called and they were like, oh, wait, actually we have the results. So like, really, right. Like, I think it's okay to like be that squeaky wheel and advocate for yourself, because no one else is going to do it for you. But on Saturday they were like, the results aren't done, but like you probably have a bacterial infection. And so I was able to get a prescription for it, and within a couple of days I was starting to feel better. So I'm not like 100% better, but I'm feeling so much better than I was. Like, I couldn't even sip water without it. Like,
trusting yourself is so important.
Yeah. So I'm
and advocating for yourself is so important.
So I'm really grateful for trusting yourself and advocating for yourself. But like, sort of on that vein, I'm also really grateful for my dad, because he's a doctor, and I called him. The first thing I did, I called him on Saturday before I called the on-call doctor, and he was like, this is what you should do. This is what's probably going to happen. And those exact things happened. So it's like really great to have like an ace in the hole, like medical person in your family. So absolutely. I'm really grateful for trusting your gut and having people in your corner who support you advocating for yourself, especially medically. Cause I think a lot of times women don't get taken seriously.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't say that this case was necessarily medical sexism, but it's something that I always sort of keep in the back of my mind, that as a woman there, you have to kind of recognize that there are greater chances that your pain or your discomfort isn't going to be taken seriously. So you really have to push for yourself. So yeah. So shout out to trusting your gut and people in your life who validate you. Okay, Devin. So it's Monday, and as our Hellions know, we award, quote unquote, the dick wad of the week. And we swear we're not making this a thing, but for the third time running, we're giving either the dick wad or the Hellion of the week to a news outlet. And
it's interesting because we've been talking a lot about media coverage of these of things in general. And so I think it's apropos that we're giving it to another news outlet.
Well, yeah. And this is actually for business practice reasons. And it's actually happening in our own backyard, which is why we wanted to focus on it. So we're giving the Dickwad of the Week to LA Weekly. And why are we doing that, Devin?
So LA Weekly was just purchased by Voice Media Group. And the new editor-in-chief is a guy named Brian Kelly. So let's stick a pin in that. I'll get back to him in a second. And after Voice Media Group purchased LA Weekly, they completely gutted it. Yeah. They got rid of 9 of the 13 members of the editorial staff, and they fired all of the writers.
All of them except one staff writer, I think.
And it is just...
I kind of want to give this a little bit more context. The buyers, like, were shrouded in secrecy. Like, they fired a lot of their staff. The buyers were shrouded in secrecy. They put out a tweet that they had deleted, where they had this graphic of, like, asking for people in LA to submit, like, original writing about, you know, living and working or whatever in LA. They're basically asking for free writing. And what was even more rich about this tweet, this graphic they use, they spelled Angelinos wrong.
Right.
Like, not only does it show that you need a fucking copy editor that you probably fired, but like it shows that you don't even know the culture of LA. You can't even spell Angelinos right.
Seminole Media Group is a company that a group of investors created 6 weeks ago specifically for the purpose of buying LA Weekly, is the new official owner. And this just goes back to sort of this idea of like shell LLCs and, like you said, Sarah, being shrouded in secrecy. Like, we don't know anything about why or how this sale happened.
Which is like, okay, that's business, but like, it's shady as fuck.
And then also another Twitter user at ELCUSH said, quote, "It's worth noting, given the LA Weekly news, that alt weeklies were one of the very best places for people of color, people with non-traditional backgrounds, and people who can't afford New York City magazine internships to get on-the-ground journalism experience. Killing them kills a pipeline."
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important point, is that, you know, these weeklies, these alt weeklies, these local magazines and local papers are where a lot of people get their start and get that experience to then move to, you know, more national publications.
Well, and I also think, too, from a consumer standpoint, like, you know, after Trump took office, there was a big push of like, get subscriptions to like Washington Post, like New York Times, like all these big like national outlets. But also it was important to subscribe to your local papers, to your local outlets, because it's like support local journalism. And it's like, but then shit like this happens.
And to add to this scary trend of, you know, getting rid of these alternative news sources is, remember I said this guy's name is Brian Kelly.
Yeah.
And for many years, he was an officer at the Claremont Institute. And the Claremont Institute mission statement is that they want people to infiltrate civic life and, quote, defeat progressivism.
Ugh.
So maybe by buying a newspaper and installing this dickwad at the head is a good way to defeat progressivism.
Mm.
So it's a really creepy story that's flying under the national radar a little bit. But I mean, we were just talking about like how we cover politics matters, how we cover stories matters.
Yeah.
And getting rid of these news sources and firing local writers is really detrimental to our larger media narrative.
Yeah, actually, there was something similar that happened to the Las Vegas Review-Journal within the last couple of years. And actually, I would highly recommend our listeners read this New Yorker article called "How the Las Vegas Review-Journal Unmasked Its Owners," because there was sort of a similar takeover from with that newspaper. And one actually staffers on that paper did good investigative journalism and found out who the new owners were, because they weren't being told. And that was like a really interesting and creepy story. But yeah, I mean, I think like local journalism is really important. And it kind of, for me, this story speaks to the crisis that is happening in journalism, which is, you know, we're seeing that more and more people are getting laid off. There are, you know, I think, God, who just bought a piece of time? Was it like one of the Koch brothers,
yes.
the Kochs or something bought a piece of time?
Yes.
We're seeing, you know, consolidation. We're seeing big money interests, obviously.
Sort of like this Brian Kelly guy or the Kochs, they're going to have editorial influence. And so this won't be independent journalism anymore. It's going to be in service of the new owners. So it's a really creepy story. It's a really important thing to keep our eyes on. And fucking pay your writers. I think I was looking on Twitter and a bunch of people quoted the Joker from the Batman series. And he said, if you're good at something, never do it for free. All right, Sarah, last but not least, we have some action items for our Hellions. So something they can do after they listen to the show. So what have you got for us today?
Yeah, so we mentioned earlier in the show that even though this tax bill was jammed through with an absolutely despicable and expedited process, it's not over. So call your reps, not just your senators, call your reps about this bill and express your displeasure about it. Put the pressure on. It's not over. There's obviously key senators to target, like Flake, Collins, Corker, Daines, Johnson, Young, Heller. Actually, Heller, there was a town hall where Heller, one of his security people, threw out a stage 4 cancer patient. So that's cool for asking a question. So fuck that guy. I hope he loses his fucking seat in 2018, but keep putting pressure on your reps. You know, it feels dire, but it's not over. So keep up the pressure. TrumpTaxScam.org is a great resource. And, you know, keep talking about it on social media. As Sarah Kendzior was telling Devin last week, like, we still have net neutrality. So keep talking
while you can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, everyone freak out more about net neutrality.
Yes.
I'm just going to throw that in there.
Please.
I'm calling an audible on the action items.
Yes, do it. And also, December 15th is the deadline to get Obamacare and get covered. So getamericacovered.org is a great resource. That deadline is coming up. It's really soon. So make sure friends and family know if they're not covered and to get covered yourself.
Finally, donate to Doug Jones, the non-pedophile candidate in Alabama, which is a thing that keeps coming out of my mouth because it's still true. Also, this morning, apparently Trump called Roy Moore to offer him his personal support. So everything is awful and disgusting. And we really need Doug Jones, the non-pedophile candidate, to win that Alabama seat. So donate, volunteer, get involved.
The guy who took on the KKK and just isn't a fucking trash fire in every single way.
That's true.
I also saw that a poll that nearly 6 in 10 white women are planning to support Roy Moore in Alabama. So like, white women, we got to get the rest of us. We got to get our shit together.
I literally just threw up in my mouth.
Yeah, we still got a lot of work to do, white women. We got a lot of work to do. And that includes not tweeting, not this white woman. Don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Yeah. Reject that impulse. So Devin, let's end our show with a quote from the fabulous bell hooks. So what do we have?
She said, "Justice demands integrity. It is to have a moral universe. Not only know what is right or wrong, but to put things in perspective, weigh things." And we just thought that it's really important to remember the importance of integrity and having a moral compass. Obviously, we talked a lot about how it doesn't seem like that's the case with these awful tax bills and pushing it through so quickly. But if you want justice, you have to have integrity. And I thought that was a really beautiful quote from bell hooks. That does it for us today. It's been a packed show as always. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you back here on Thursday. For more information on today's episodes, including links to the articles we discussed and additional resources, you can visit us online at hellbentpodcast.com.
And you can follow us across social media platforms. We're at HellbentPod on Twitter and Instagram. We're Hellbent Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to join our Facebook group, we are facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone. You can also follow myself, Sarah Lerner, on Twitter @SarahLerner. And you can also follow Devin on Twitter @DevinHandy.
We also have a Patreon if you would like to support us that way.
Yes, and you can find us on patreon.com/hellbentpodcast, and your support would mean a lot. Thank you.